PPI.org.
Disability and Progress. We bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Thanks to Mason Butler for recording this episode. If you'd like to join us by being connected, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Today's episode is Spina Bifida. We have with us Dr. Daniel Guillaume and Jay Armstrong. Dr. Guillaume is a pediatric neurosurgeon at the University Medical School. And Jay Armstrong is a parent with a child with spina bifida. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello, Sam.
Thank you both for joining me. I really appreciate that. Did I get your title right, Dr. Guillaume?
Yes, thank you. It's
perfect. Okay, excellent. And I want to start out with you by talking a little bit about how you chose the path you chose with your being a neurosurgeon and choosing spina bifida.
Well, thanks. Again, it's wonderful to be here. So as you said, I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon, and we take care of a lot of patients with spina bifida. And it was not a very straight path. Initially, when I went to medical school, I wanted to become a neurologist. During my later years of training, I went into the operating room to just kind of broaden my perspective. And I kind of fell in love with neurosurgery and ended up going down that path. And it was during my training that I became very interested in particularly pediatric neurosurgery, because a lot of these patients, these kids, taking care of them can be very challenging and also very gratifying at the same time. These kids have sometimes very serious problems requiring, you know, a lifetime of care. And when you make a difference in a child's life, it's really, you're affecting a whole lifetime.
I'd like to talk about exactly the definition of what is spina bifida.
Sure. So yeah, spina bifida is really a broad term, and it really refers to a cleft or an opening in the vertebrae of the spine. It's something that it's part of a neural tube defect. The way people develop spina bifida, and you know, again, it's many disorders. It happens really early on in their development. So after actually within the first month of gestation. When the embryo is formed, part of the tissue is meant to become the whole central nervous system and the skin. And the central nervous system begins as a little groove in that tissue, and the sides come up as ridges, and eventually this becomes a tube that closes. And for some reasons, which we actually don't completely understand, when this neural tube fails to close completely, there ends up being a gap in the back, and that can allow varying degrees of problems to occur, from no problem at all to the contents of the spine coming out. So that's what spina bifida is. There's many types of diseases within that.
So what are the risks of having a child with spina bifida?
I'm sorry, do you mean the risk of developing that?
Right.
Yeah, great question. So there's many, there's both genetic and non-genetic things which can lead to spina bifida, which can increase somebody's risk. The genetic parts of this, we've known this for, you know, more than 50 years, that there's a genetic component. And we think that probably between 60 and 70% of people who have spina bifida is due to a gene defect. And we know this because back in the 1960s, even, people were doing familial studies, and they were learning that if a child is born in a family and has spina bifida, the next child has between a 2 and a 5% risk of developing the same disease, which is about 20 to 50 times higher than the general risk. And you know, the further cousins have a little bit of a lower risk and so forth. And those genetic factors haven't quite been worked out. And there's a lot of other things that increase the risk of that. The most well-known is probably diminished folate. People have folate deficiencies or don't take vitamins. They can have a significantly increased risk. Other factors would maternal obesity has been reported, where if the mother has a high body mass index, particularly greater than 30 or 35, there's a higher chance of developing that. And it appears to be the higher that BMI is, the higher the risk. Maternal diabetes also can predispose to a wide range of birth defects, including spina bifida. I mean, again, hyperglycemia, you know, increased glucose is probably the factor behind both of those. There's some drugs. Valproic acid is a common one. This is a drug that's used to treat seizure disorders. And when women take that during their first trimester of pregnancy, it can increase the risk by 10 times.
Oh, my.
And then there's some environmental factors that have been studied which can also increase the risk. Toxins and pollutants, and Agent Orange is one of them that's been investigated. And people feel that has a role in increasing the risk.
So in lieu of all those factors you gave, are there any other ways of reducing the risk of having a child with spina bifida?
Yeah, that's a great question. So probably the most well-known, again, is folate deficiency. So it was discovered that folate deficiency can increase the risk because people were studying, you know, looking at comparing families of children that had spina bifida with those that didn't, and then looking at maternal folate metabolism. So this is, again, how it actually works is not really well known, but folate is a B vitamin. Mm-hmm. And this has led to mandatory folic acid fortification of grain products, and doctors in the USA have told women of childbearing age to take prenatal vitamins which have folic acid. And if mm-hmm. somebody has a high risk, is in one of those categories we talked about earlier, they should take more folic acid. The prenatal vitamin amount is about 0.4 milligrams per day. And if somebody is at high risk, they should take 4 milligrams a day. And this has really decreased the risk of all neural tube defects, including spina bifida, by across the world by 30 to 40%.
It sounds like there are, you know, all neurotube defects are not spina bifida, but is there more than one type of spina bifida?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, there's kind of a range, and it depends on the location and how big the defect is. The most common way people think about it is open defects and closed defects. And what I mean by that is if the skin is covering the lesion or not. I think the example that most people think of is myelomeningocele, which would probably be the most severe form. And that's when the defect is quite large, and the muscle is involved, the fascia, the bone is open, the dura and all the coverings of the spinal cord are spread apart. And in fact, the spinal cord herniates out through the defect in the bone and comes out outside of the skin. And it's kind of like a book that's opened up where all the pages are open. And when the child is born, you can actually see their spinal cord on their skin. And there's usually a lot of fluid with that. That can result in a lot of problems depending on how high the lesion is. Typically there's a lack of function below that level. So a motor function, sensation loss, which can cause pressure sores, have trouble with bowel and bladder function, orthopedic deformities like club foot, all these things. Another type of open defect that's not quite as severe is when only fluid comes out, the spinal fluid and the spinal cord and all the nerves remain inside. And that really doesn't cause any major problems. The skin-covered lesions, the most mild form is something we call spina bifida occulta. And in most of those conditions, people don't even know they have the disease. This affects anywhere from 10 to 15% of all people. And that can really just be a little cleft in the bone where everything else is normal. And there's another range, I guess, of closed defects where there can be fat tissue that's kind of involved with spinal cord elements and other tissues that can create varying degrees of disability. So there really is a lot of varieties.
I want to go back to something you said in regards to the open spinal cord, where you said sometimes just a loss of fluid and that's not as bad. It sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Can you replace that, or how, because the fluid should be something that is incredibly useful for a person.
Right.
What happens then?
Yeah, great question. So I guess I didn't explain it very well. So what it is spinal fluid. So what happens with a meningocele as opposed to, so myelo refers to, myelo is Latin for spinal cord, and meningo refers to the meninges. So myelomeningocele is where the spinal cord and the meninges are the covering of the spinal cord, where that all herniates out through the defect. A meningocele is where only the dura, which is the covering of the spinal cord, kind of protrudes out. So it's like a hernia that pokes out through the back, and the other tissues don't close around that. And what is inside that sac of fluid is spinal fluid. And we actually produce cerebrospinal fluid in our brains and throughout our bodies actually continuously. We make a lot of spinal fluid every day. So when a child is born with that, really it's just a matter of kind of reducing the hernia, getting rid of the excess fluid, putting the normal meninges or dura back into the canal where they belong, and then putting everything back together, kind of like folding the pages of the book back together.
And presumably the brain will replenish the spinal fluid?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it takes about, our brains can replenish all the spinal fluid in our body in less than 12 hours.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
How often does spina bifida occur, and is there a gender or ethnicity preference?
Yeah. Great question. So spina bifida is pretty common in the world. It's actually one of the most common congenital malformations in the world. The worldwide estimate is around one in every 2,000 births worldwide. And that, like you said, it does vary a lot from place to place and within different types of people. There's always known to be some geographic variation in that. For example, in the world, Ireland and Scotland have very high frequencies. It's about 10 per 1,000.
Why is that?
That's a great question. It's actually not known. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody really knows. There's in the U.S., it's much lower, and there is some variation in race. For example, Hispanics have the highest incidence with about 4 out of every 10,000. In non-Hispanic whites, it's a little bit more than 3 out of 10,000, and in African Americans, it's lower, around 2.5 out of 10,000. And it's a little bit higher. It's a little bit more common in females, and again for an unknown reason. And it's hard to measure. So. There's the geographic variations. The reason it's difficult to really know is because in certain areas, people are more likely to terminate their pregnancy than others. And that sort of confounds the measurement a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And so Originally, did you say one out of every 2,000 and overall?
Overall, yeah, there's about every year there's about 140,000 new cases in the world.
Percentage-wise, does that feel high to you?
Yeah, it does.
Jay, I wanted to go to you. You are a parent with a child with spina bifida. How old is she?
Sophie is now 12 years old and in seventh grade.
So tell me the story.
Well, I guess the story for most of the families that you talk to that have a child or children with spina bifida is the first ultrasound. And so we had the first ultrasound for Sophie, who happens to have a twin sister who does not have spina bifida. And so at the 20-week ultrasound, and I'm still this, but they identified it at 20 weeks.
Wow. Dr. Guillaume, I'm just curious. So this was a case of twins, one with spina bifida and one without. In the case of when you have twins, is that a usual thing?
Great question. Yeah, so even though the incidence is higher within a family, it's still a rare disease. So it's more likely to not have an affected sibling than there is. But just compared to the general population, there's a bit of a higher risk.
So Jim, go ahead and go on. I'm curious then what you know your reactions were. Obviously, it was a shock and whatnot. And what were some of the decisions you made that, and how did you redesign kind of your guys' lives to prepare for this?
Well, I guess first of all, we felt very lucky that we were in the Twin Cities because it really does have some world-class medical facilities here. Mm-hmm. And so we were going to United Hospital and Children's in St. Paul, and the doctor there had sent us to the ultrasound. And we actually were able to meet with the genetic counselor the same day that we found out. And yes, it was a shock. Sophie has an older sister. Two older sisters, but she had an older sister that had another congenital birth defect called trisomy 18 and who had died at birth. And so to go in for a second ultrasound and have a congenital birth defect revealed was even more of a shock, knowing what had happened with her sister, Lauren. But because she was a twin, we were given the option of terminating the pregnancy, and we weren't anywhere close to doing that. But we were also, we had been made known that because they were twins, they were going to be early. And so Sophie was actually born 6 weeks early, along with her sister, and within 24 hours had her first surgery.
And now she is currently in seventh grade. Talk a little bit about what kind of person she is today. What are her strengths and what does she have difficulty with?
Well, she's very vivacious. She's outgoing and very engaging. And there's a spectrum of for spina bifida kids and people in terms of how affected you are by this. And we felt very lucky that she's on the very functional end. 90% of kids or children that are born with spina bifida eventually end up having a shunt installed within the first 2 years. And they tell you if you can make it to 2 years, then you probably made it through the window. And Sophie was one of those 10% that did not require a shunt. So she's also ambulatory, which means that she can walk. She's got a funny gait, but with her two sisters, she does her best to try to keep up. Mm-hmm. So we mainstreamed Sophie, and throughout school, we made sure that she and her sister were in separate sections in class. And luckily, we went to schools and daycares that allowed for that to happen, because we really wanted two things. We wanted Sophie's sister not to feel like she had to look after her sister all the time. And we wanted Sophie to really develop an independence as well. And I think that's more than paid off so far.
Dr. Guillaume, I want to talk a little bit about surgery, since it seems like that's something that I saw kind of came up a lot. And there was mentions of prenatal and postnatal surgery. Could you talk a little bit about the difference and why or what they would do exactly?
Sure. And it was, you know, it's great to hear Jay's story about Sophie. That's sounds like a good outcome. So traditionally, so neurosurgeons get involved, kind of like what Jay said, what Jay told you. This is we get involved prenatally. Usually it's when we meet the family and start talking about surgery. But kind of as you heard, traditionally the myelomeningocele would need to be closed usually within the first day or two after the child is born. The purpose of that is manyfold. One is to restore normal anatomy, put the spinal cord back in where it belongs and close all the layers to reduce the risk of infection. Ultimately, you'd like to, and also to reduce the risk of something called tethering, where the tethering is where the spinal cord is stuck to something. When the child's born, it's actually attached to their skin. So as they would grow taller, that would put tension on the spinal cord. And you want to, and also there's other benefits to that. There's the rationale behind prenatal closure, and what prenatal closure means is doing a hysterectomy halfway through the pregnancy, basically delivering the child and closing the defect at that time, and then putting them back in to complete the pregnancy. It sounds like a crazy thing, but it's But this idea came up, more than three decades ago. And people were doing it in animals, and there was two rationales for doing that. One is when the event happens during the first month of gestation before people know that they're pregnant, and there's a spinal cord that's outside of the body that's sitting in the uterus in the intrauterine environment. And the amniotic fluid is actually toxic to that tissue. It's thought to be toxic to that tissue, so that it can cause further damage the longer that it's exposed. So one benefit was thought to sort of cover that tissue and protect it. And then the second is people with myelomeningocele, when the fluid is kind of draining out through the back while the rest of the brain is developing, the very back part of the brain, which we call the hindbrain, that's the brainstem and the cerebellum, can actually slip down into the cervical canal, the part of the body where the cervical spinal cord should live. And the brainstem can go down through there with part of the brain, because there's like a funnel effect. Things are being pulled down through the back. And that actually affects the way the brain develops too. And that's why, like Jay said, 90% of these kids can get a buildup of fluid on the brain, hydrocephalus, requiring a shunt. So the idea was that if you can close these babies halfway through the pregnancy, you can prevent that from happening as well. So the first time this was done successfully was in 1998 in a patient, and then a lot of people started doing this throughout the country, and it was a little bit uncontrolled. So in 2003, it was decided to do a study where the only people that would have this prenatal surgery would be if they were enrolled in a trial. This was an NIH-sponsored trial, and they called it the Management of Myelomeningocele Study, or MOMS trial. And it was really kind of a head-to-head comparison where people were enrolled, and then they were randomly assigned to either the traditional postnatal closure or to be done in utero between 19 and 25 weeks gestation. And there was the enrollment criteria was very strict. You know, we were avoiding people with high risk issues like maternal diabetes, obesity, twin pregnancies, things like that. Really, they looked at a few main outcomes. The primary outcome was if the kids would need a shunt within their first 12 months of life or not. Another one was if they would die. That was kind of the composite primary outcome. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, there was sort of an assessment of mental and motor development by age 30 months. And what they actually planned on enrolling 200 people. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, they stopped the trial early after only enrolling 183 because it was very clear that the prenatal group had better outcomes. Specifically, the need for a shunt by 12 months in the postnatal group, the traditional group, it was about 80%. And in the prenatal group, it was 40%. So really only about half. And that was because this hindbrain herniation problem was significantly better in the prenatal group. And walking was also much better. You know, the motor function score was a lot higher in the prenatal group. It was 42% of people were walking independently at 30 months in the prenatal group compared to only 21% in the traditional group.
Really?
So really, really a lot of benefits. There was a few downsides for the mother. You know, having a history halfway through your pregnancy predisposes to preterm labor. Mm. So the mothers who underwent the prenatal closure had their deliveries on average about 3 weeks earlier. It was about 34 weeks gestation compared to 37 weeks in the other group. And also some of these, they were more prone to uterine dehiscence. But overall, it looks like it's a better thing for the baby now, and more centers are doing that.
So presumably this would mean that Sophie's mom would never have been a candidate because she was carrying twins for this particular thing.
Exactly.
Also, the idea that for the mom, did you say a hysterectomy is performed?
So what you basically the way that the procedure is done is through it, an abdominal decision, the baby is brought out, and the myelomeningocele is closed, and then the baby is put back in to complete the pregnancy.
But does this eliminate the mother ever having future children? Right?
Oh no, they can have down the road.
Okay.
Good question.
So. So this particular thing ranks much higher to be able to do it prenatal.
Correct. Yeah. And people are even, it looks like it's better overall, you know, with, again, you want to, certain people are not eligible. It's not, you know, people have looked at this very carefully, and it's good for some, but not for others. Jay's example, you know, Sophie might be an example. So for example, patients that had either really high myelomeningoceles in the thoracic area, or really low ones in the sacrum, were excluded because those patients generally have, if it's thoracic, they generally have very bad outcomes. And if it's in the sacrum, they generally have really good outcomes no matter what. So it's no reason to put forth the risk there. And also all the patients that were enrolled had a Chiari 2 malformation, which is that hindbrain herniation problem I talked about. So it's really to select people.
And the prenatal surgery sounds like it's fairly complex. I presume that there are only a very, you know, that it would be very expensive and that there's only a few hospitals that do the microsurgery type thing.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's, again, it requires a real, you know, kind of a specialized team, including a fetal medicine surgeon, and as well as a neurosurgeon and you know, everybody else. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few more centers doing it now. And I don't really know, I can't tell you how many across the U.S., but many people are developing the expertise because it is such a good thing.
If one is carrying twins, I presume the reason that you couldn't do the surgery would be at risk of losing the other twin.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. And I should mention that the technique's improving. Some in some places, this there's something called fetoscopic. Basically, it's an endoscopic technique where you can people are actually able to do the procedure through a really small incision where they can put endoscopes in. So that's the technology is developing, and I think things will get much better with time.
I want to talk briefly, Jay, about I presume Sophie had the surgery after she was born.
She did.
Okay.
And so within 24 hours, she had the surgery. And so, like Dr. Guillaume had mentioned, the three types of spina bifida, which is a neural tube defect. Sophie has the myelomeningocele, which means that she had part of her spinal column protruding out her back when she was born. And so it was actually a holiday when she was born, and the surgeon was actually brought in on his holiday and performed the surgery.
Wow.
And then she stayed in the hospital along with her sister in neonatal ICU. Mm-hmm. But amazingly enough, she actually came home before her sister did.
Oh, really? Wow.
And
what did you mark that down for? How do you suppose she was able to do that?
We always, the intra-family legend is that her sister just wasn't ready to come home yet or be born yet. She wanted to, she thought it was a little early. And so she had had problems maintaining her body temperature, and that's why her sister remained in the ICU a few more days after Sophie came home. But I forgot to add that when families get together, and those with spina bifida, almost immediately everybody kind of identifies like, well, I'm in Sophie's case, she's in L5, L4, and myomeningocele. And then everybody else will offer up what where their opening is in their spine. And so like the doctor said, you know, those patients that actually have very high openings near the neck sometimes are not really affected, but slightly lower down, and then they're profoundly affected.
Dr. Guillaume, is it common that if one has twins and one is affected with spina bifida, that the other twin has problems as well? Maybe not necessarily that, but with other things, or are they left untouched?
Yeah, great question. Again, it varies quite a bit. I think the most common thing we see is when one twin has it, the other one is fine, is normal, unless there's some syndrome, there's like a chromosomal abnormality that they both inherited. But
you both have mentioned a term that I'd like to discuss and make sure my radio population understands what it is, and it's hydrocephalus. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how that affects things?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to talk about that. Hydrocephalus is a pediatric neurosurgeon. It's actually the most common condition we treat overall. And like Jay said, it happens in, 85 upwards, depending on the level, 85% of patients with spina bifida. So what that is, people, you probably heard hydrocephalus means water on the brain, and it's,
right.
it's not exactly that, but it's a buildup of cerebrospinal fluid inside the brain. It's actually in the middle of the brain. So there's four fluid spaces inside the brain called ventricles, and inside these spaces, we produce cerebrospinal fluid continuously throughout our whole life. So it's like little faucets that are turned on. And in fact, as adults, we make about a half a liter of fluid every day. Whereas it circulates inside our brain and then outside our brain and outside of our spinal cord. And it ultimately has to get absorbed into the venous system or into the lymphatics. And hydrocephalus develops when the fluid is being produced, but there's been some sort of obstruction in the pathway for clearance. So the way I like to describe it to patients is it's like the faucet's turned on, but the drain is plugged up.
Okay.
And the fluid's no longer getting drained. And sometimes the drain is completely plugged where there's no fluid getting out. And that's a very severe type of hydrocephalus. And if that doesn't get treated, patients can die very quickly. And then oftentimes it's a slow leak, you know, and again, you imagine your sink where there's some gunk in the drain or something like that, and it just kind of drains slowly. Mm-hmm. And people that have spina bifida, for example, this hindbrain herniation can interfere with the drain, with the clearance of fluid, and that fluid can build up. It can happen very quickly, or like Jade mentioned, it can happen over a year or two. And that's the most common treatment for that is something called a shunt, a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. A shunt is a new drain. Basically, it's creating a new drainage system for the brain to get that fluid out, and it's a diversion. So one end of it's a tube where one end of the tube will go inside the ventricle, and then it tunnels under the skin, and it drains into another part of the body. Usually it's the peritoneum, which is in the abdomen. It's the fluid space around all of the abdominal organs. That's the most common way we treat it. And again, the amount of kids with spina bifida who have hydrocephalus, it actually varies according to the level too. Kids that have very low lesions in the sacrum, the incidence of hydrocephalus is much lower. And if it's in the thoracic area, it's much higher.
So it sounds like Sophie was, I think he said she did not need a shunt. It sounds like she was incredibly lucky.
Yeah, I think that's great to hear that.
So the shunt is, you don't see it then if it's done, it's...
Yeah, great question. So yeah, there's three parts to the shunt. There's the catheter that goes into the brain. There's the catheter that goes into the peritoneum in the abdomen. And kind of between those two catheters up on the head, is a valve, and the valve regulates the flow. It doesn't allow backwards flow, and it keeps the pressure normal. And that sometimes you can see a little bump, particularly in babies, you can see a little bump where that the valve is. Mm-hmm. But in most adults, you can't see the shunt.
So presumably, since the treatments have gotten better and better, the life longevity of people, how long they live with spina bifida, is better and better.
Correct. Yeah. And that's exactly the case. In fact, several decades ago, we were taught when I was in medical school, we were taught that patients with spina bifida would die in their 30s and 40s. And that was, you know, that was according to old literature. And then we were, you know, there's some people who say that the mortality is around 1% per year from age 5 onwards. That's actually probably... really not the case anymore. Most of the patients would die from renal problems or shunt problems, an obstruction of their shunt, so hydrocephalus. And the reality is we've really learned how to treat these conditions much better in the last few decades. And we have a handle on all these things. So kids are really, I should say adults are living normal lives. And we see, you know, we have spina bifida patients in their 70s now, and things just keep getting better.
I presume that there is some kind of difference, though, with how well patients do from being treated in the 1960s or whatever, as opposed to now or in 2000s or even 1990s.
That's exactly right. So it's hard to, right. So the people that we're seeing that are in their 50s and 60s now, remember they have not had the modern treatments. They've exactly right. So will the stuff that we've been doing in the last decade or two, really we're going to need 50 years to know the outcomes of that. But I really think it's things have turned around.
So is there a way to go back and do anything different with some of these people that are older and didn't have them? I'm thinking particularly with shunts or whatnot. Maybe that would have been changed how you do things with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, one of the downsides to a shunt that I didn't mention is they are mechanical devices, and they tend not to be perfect. So they they require maintenance. They can get plugged up, they can get infected, and when that happens, they need to be fixed. And when people who have, if somebody comes in that's 50 years old that had a shunt put in 1970, if they come in with their shunt malfunction, that for one thing, that's pretty good if they went that long. But the tendency is to replace it with a modern device. And we have modern techniques that make the shunt less likely to fail or get infected. And I think the same is true for all types of medical care.
There sounds like, you know, it feels pretty scary talking about this in regards to all the things that may have to go on. Anytime you mess with the head or the brain, to me is one of those, you know, I always think of as taboo things you should not touch. is there a lot of learning disabilities that happens with things like this?
That's a really good question. It's been, it's sort of, there's sort of some controversy, and it really varies a lot. In general, when people have looked at this very seriously, most patients with spina bifida have normal intelligence. And a lot of the reports will report up to 80% of children with spina bifida don't have learning difficulties. Mm-hmm. Certainly, hydrocephalus itself, if it's not treated well, can cause learning difficulties. There are some patients with spina bifida have some problems that can actually interfere with their learning that are a little bit indirect. For example, you can imagine being an elementary school child having problems with bowel and bladder function, or maybe being wheelchair or something. That can be associated with things like anxiety and depression, which can interfere with learning. So sometimes focusing, you know, those are all complicated issues that can all interfere with a child's ability to kind of focus and learn if they're dealing with those issues too. But in general, people with spina bifida have normal intelligence.
Jay, how would anybody know that Sophie had spina bifida?
The first telltale sign would be her gait, the way she walks. And a lot of times she'll walk with one or two arm crutches.
Okay.
And so that's the first thing that jumps out. But so as a elementary school student and now a preteen, the bowel and bladder issues are definitely profound in terms of self-worth and self-esteem.
Yeah.
So we chose for Sophie to have two surgeries, and she's had 13 surgeries so far.
Oh, wow.
But she's has what they call she's had an ACE procedure and a Trofanoff, if I always get that word right or wrong. So what she ends up having to do, and like the doctor had mentioned before, in previous years, you know, the life expectancy was shortened due to renal failure. And a lot of that, as I understand it, is due to what happens with the kidneys when you're not able to evacuate, and you do that day in, day out, and your kidneys really wear out. So with the Mitrofanov and the ACE, Sophie actually has to use a catheter every 2 hours while she's awake to empty her bladder. And then once a day, she has to essentially flush out her colon and remain in the bathroom for an hour while that stimulates and flushes out.
That sounds like rough, especially for a preteen. But Dr. Guillaume, do you want to speak to that? It sounds like this might be kind of common.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm really glad that Jay's here to talk about Sophie. I think this really, he's really, really kind of describing it very well. But these, yeah, and it's really, like I said, it varies quite a bit. There's, but urological problems and bowel problems. And Jay explained it very well. This is clean intermittent catheterization medications and oftentimes an ACE procedure or metoprolol to help people keep their bladder empty to avoid hydronephrosis. These are very important things. And sometimes, bowel function is a big one. A neurogenic bowel can result in constipation, and a very aggressive bowel regimen is a common thing. Because the sacral, really, that's the lowest nerves that come out, S2, 3, and 4, are the nerves that innervate our bowel and bladder. Those are lower than the nerves for our leg and much lower than that to avoid all of this. There's other things that can happen too. Kids can get, if the lesion's a little bit higher, orthopedic problems, scoliosis, sometimes trouble moving their ankles back and forth, so they need to wear braces on their feet in order to walk. We've talked about hydrocephalus.
I'm wondering, with the bowel and bladder, any thoughts of anything going on now that could help in the future to change any of this, both with people with the existing problems and people that will have children with this?
Yeah. So just with regard to bowel and bladder.
With this particular defect.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of, great point. So there's a lot of things. Yeah. Really the goal of the bladder procedures is to decrease the backflow of pressure going into the kidneys. And really, people with spina bifida just have trouble voiding, really. A lot of this neurogenic bladder, it's just a problem with innervation to the bladder. So these procedures, really help quite a bit. There's other procedures, injecting Botox and things like this to kind of expand the bladder, but it's all meant to just decrease the pressure inside the bladder. The goal is, re-innervating the bladder and making the bladder work. There is research happening in that area, and I don't know the details behind that, but I know there's a ways to go with that.
I just think about, where right now they're kids, but later they'll transition into adults, obviously. And, you'll have that whole dating, which is difficult for anybody who has, quote, everything functioning. Also your job and whatever else you have. What is there to help them transition, or is it generally left up to the parents?
Yeah. So, are you asking me or Jay?
Either one of you, whoever wants to answer it.
do you want to go first, Jay, or I can talk a little bit, but you might have some good perspective on that.
No, I'll let you go first and then I'll add in.
Yeah. So there's it's really a family, having a child with, and I can't speak, I can only speak from the perspective of a doctor. I'm sure Jay's perspective will be much more realistic than mine. Since I'm a surgeon, who kind of just is focused on one aspect of this child's development, but family-based interventions are becoming, it's pretty clear that, a lot of these people, as they grow up, they have, just like any child, with a disability, there's a lot to overcome. I mean, it's hard enough to be a child without a disability, even it's hard for some kids to, in this common world with social media and,
tell me about it.
Yeah, there's a lot it's hard for all kids. You throw on top of that a disability that interferes with your bowel and bladder function, or that maybe puts you in a wheelchair. that really has to be extremely hard for kids and for families. So there's, I know that most spina bifida programs, there's a focus on family-based interventions and kind of helping people get through this. You know, there's, you know, the psychosocial development and quality of life, social skills. These things all have to be addressed, including depression and anxiety, which is higher, which is more common in,
right,
in children like that. So it really, it requires an effort and a focus throughout all those developing years.
Did you want to add anything, Jay?
Well, I was just going to backtrack a little bit and go back to potential treatments. And from a family's perspective, I think in the spina bifida support world, there's a lot of hope that at some point stem cell research might be helpful. And I know there's a clinic out in California that's really on the cutting edge of this. But I was also going to add that there are also clinics not inside the U.S. I know of one in Taiwan and one across the border in Mexico that are already doing some experimental treatments for spina bifida by injecting stem cells into the area and using various chemicals to try to repair certain sets of injured nerves. But those are rather expensive. The last time I checked, they were like $25,000 on up, and there's a good deal of concern as to whether they do anything or they might be harmful.
So Dr. Guillaume, how close are we to this as far as, you know, you have the FDA and everything, but realistically, do you see promise with this?
Yeah, so this is a great, in terms, there's a lot of research happening, looking at improving function. So stem cells, it was actually decades ago when people started looking at injecting stem cells into the spinal cord for a variety of things, including spina bifida. There's research looking at, for example, during intrauterine closure of injecting stem cells at that time. And then also, like Jay was saying, after the child is already born, people who are, you know, much older are getting, are going out of the country for stem cell therapy to have these cells directly into their spinal cord. And there's the two thoughts are, one, can these cells, there's actually a variety of different types of cells that have been used, cord blood stem cells,
right,
induced pluripotent stem cells. There's quite a few different types. Part of it is thinking that these cells can differentiate into neurons and supportive cells of the spinal cord and integrate and become part of the spinal cord tissue. And a lot of the studies have not shown that actually happens. In other words, the neurons don't really develop axons and connect very well to the other cells become part of the neural network. They do change what we call the microenvironment. So they can create an environment through secretion of growth factors and trophic factors that can promote kind of recovery of the spinal cord. And there's certainly, I know it's being done in Mexico, and I know in California there's a lot of research being done. I don't know of any FDA approval for anything in this country right now.
Right.
And I'm not aware of any NIH supported trials or anything like that. So I think it's still at the early stages.
Dr. Guillaume, where can somebody go if they're interested in getting involved in studies or want to find out more about what they can do with spina bifida?
To enroll to
yes.
So I don't know, since we're not doing any clinical trials here, I guess I'm not aware. I know if you go to clinicaltrial.gov,
okay,
there's a list of all, and there's a way to search for spina bifida. That's one way to find out. And I haven't been on the spina bifida websites for, you know, there is a spina bifida foundation. Jay, you might know more about this. They might have access to that, but I think it's hard for a parent to find clinical trials unless there's a network through this foundation. I don't know if Jay's aware of anything.
Well, so on the flip side, there's about 4 kids a day in the United States, I think is the average. Right. And so with spina bifida in some form. So the other kind of problem for Sophie, or one of the situations she runs into, are finding other kids with the same condition. Mm-hmm. And so there's Sanford Health provides a camp every summer for spina bifida kids only that I know is very popular. But outside of the week with the camps, it can be very tough to find other playmates and peers right. that have this, that they can actually interact with and kind of commiserate and mm-hmm. and enjoy themselves.
Right.
We need to wrap things up. So if each of you want to give any final comments or anything about spinal bifida or anything about advice maybe you'd give to parents or anything like that.
I just want to say it's been a pleasure to be part of this. And I think things just keep getting better. There's a lot of research happening beyond stem cells. People are looking at it ways to, you know, I think the most important one area is trying to prevent this. If you can imagine how many people are born with this condition throughout the world and what, you know, what cost this has on society, not just the monetary cost, but on
right.
Quality of life and all these other things. If we could prevent this, that would be amazing. And I think that work is, you know, first looking at understanding the genetics and how the neural tube closes, but, you know, folate supplementation is a very cheap and easy thing to do. And that's brought the world incidence down by up to 40%. So I think, and there's other things happening. So I think the future is bright. I think it's, And I have a lot of admiration and respect for children with this problem, and I think it's a pleasure to be part of their care team.
Jay, any comments from you?
Well, just gratitude for the health professionals because it's quite clear to us that Sophie's quality of life is dramatically better than it could have been had she been born in a different time or different location. And we've used just about all the facilities or healthcare providers from the University of Minnesota to Gillette to Shriners to Children's Hospitals. And to have that local has just been so wonderful. And I just want to give a shout out to you as well, Sam, that even though you don't talk about spina bifida all the time, it's really helpful and very interesting to have a show like this that really has these types of discussions about things that normally aren't brought up in regular conversation.
Thank you very much. I do want to make a comment quick, but it seems like when I was growing up, I did hear about it more. Very quickly, Dr. Guillaume, I don't seem to hear about it as much. And you talked about how folate is, you know, making the odds better. Do you feel like that's what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Like I said earlier, there are parts of the country where the incidence actually went down because people were actually terminating their pregnancies. But that's not such a factor here, and we actually are seeing a decrease, likely because of different prenatal care and folate.
I want to thank you both for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time. And you guys are what makes this show work. So thank you very much. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you'd like to be a part of the email list, You may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Tonight, we were speaking about spina bifida, and we were speaking with Dr. Daniel Guillaume, and who is a neurosurgeon at the University Medical School in Minnesota, and with Jay Armstrong, who's a parent of a child with a spina bifida. Thanks so much for joining in. Good night.
KPI.org.